Hello and welcome to Occupied Thoughts, a podcast brought to you by the Foundation for Middle East Peace. I'm Rania Batrice, non-resident fellow at the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Today is Wednesday, March 6th, and I'm so happy to be joined by Crystal Ball. Crystal is the co-host of Breaking Point with Crystal and Sagar, and she's also the co-host of Crystal, Kyle, and Friends. I've long admired Crystal for her just deep commitment to the truth in journalism, and now more than ever, her voice and her that commitment are so important. So thank you so much, Crystal, for being with us.
It is my pleasure. I don't deserve that kind introduction, but it is much appreciated.
Thank you. So we're going to talk today about systemic bias in the media, something that you are just an expert in. You articulate so well for everybody to understand. We're going to focus on how this media bias is showing up in reporting on specific areas, the allegation that Hamas committed pervasive and widespread sexual violence against Israeli victims on October 7th, as well as, folks have probably heard by this point, the December 28th New York Times article titled Screams Without Words, in which the Times claims to establish, and I'm quoting, the attacks against women were not isolated events, but part of a broader pattern of gender-based violence on October 7th. It has to be said, it kind of goes without saying, but we have to name it. Talking about sexual violence is always sensitive. It's painful. It's difficult. It's something that people experience in extremely personal ways and in different ways from person to person. And given how widespread sexual violence is in the world, there are no doubt people listening to this podcast who are survivors of sexual violence themselves. It's, as we said, pervasive. And speaking from experience, it's very difficult in the vast majority of situations, if not every situation, for survivors to disclose. And we know that. We also know that Hamas committed atrocities against civilians on October 7th. The question we are asking today is not, did it happen or didn't it happen? But there are serious allegations from the Israeli government. And I say this often, I don't trust the Israeli government, but the allegations, all of them, must be independently investigated. And our question is, how are these allegations of sexual assault by Hamas being framed in our media? What are they being used to justify? And then, in the case of the New York Times article, it's extremely important and valuable here in what we're discussing. So, we're just going to start there. And, Crystal, I'm just going to dive in and get us kicked off and ask you some questions. And this is a space that you are very well experienced, again, talking about media bias. And you recently did such an incredibly important segment on the ongoing and what you called a massive scandal related to the New York Times. And we're going to include the link in the show notes to that really important segment. But this scandal relates to that explosive New York Times article published in late December that I just mentioned. And it purported to have carried out an investigation that uncovered the new details showing a pattern of rape, mutilation, and extreme brutality against women in the attacks on Israel. So, can you just give us a quick synopsis of that, just to get us started?
Yes, I'm not sure how quick it will be, but I'm happy to give a synopsis. I appreciate your framing here because I also want to start with a little bit of framing, which is that the reason why it's important to dig into these claims and to demand evidence for especially the most far-reaching claims that have been made by the Israeli government in the wake of October 7th is not to deny that atrocities were committed. But we know the way that some of the most visceral examples, which were cited in the immediate wake of those horrors, were first of all fabrications, and second of all, they were weaponized to justify what is ultimately unjustifiable, the collective punishment and all-out assault of Israel on the Gaza Strip, including millions of innocent civilians. And, I don't even know we have anything close to an accurate death toll in terms of what the immediate deadly cost has been to that population. So those are two things I want to make clear. It's not that I enjoy nitpicking all of this. I don't, but the truth does matter for that reason. But I also want to say that even if the most far-reaching claims of the Israeli government, like the 40 beheaded babies story, which we know now was not accurate whatsoever, even if those things were true, it would not have justified what was done. But these were some of the stories that were used in an attempt to make the Israeli barbarism vis-a-vis Palestinians acceptable to a mass audience. So with regards to this New York Times story, one of the claims that was immediately made by the Israeli government was not just that sexual violence had occurred in the context of this conflict, but that it had been used systematically as a weapon of war. And so the purpose of this investigation from the New York Times was an attempt effectively to prove that allegation true. And I use that framing very intentionally because the reporting that other fantastic journalists, the Gray Zone people, Z Squirrel, Ryan Grimm, Jeremy Scahill, Daniel Bogoslop at The Intercept, all credit to them for uncovering all of these pieces. I've just been tracking it and trying to put it together for people. One of the things that they uncovered is that it really seems like they had that conclusion and then sought to try to fill in details to justify that conclusion, which is, of course, not what journalism is. Journalism right. is a search for the
exactly.
truth, not accepting, okay, this is what we believe happened. Now we're going to try to figure out, you know, what is the actual reality. So this story gets published. It gets news alerted. You know, they publish it as a big bombshell. They've got one of their big guns, Jeffrey Gettleman, Pulitzer Prize winner, on the byline, along with two other people. This becomes relevant, Anat Schwartz and Adam Sella. And they get it in right under the wire for the year-end award submissions. It's part of their, you know, submission package for additional Pulitzers, et cetera. And immediately after publication of this report, which asserted that to prove that systematic use of sexual violence as a weapon of war did in fact occur on October 7th, the report immediately starts to come under scrutiny and fall apart. Primarily, the initial thing that came out was that one of the three alleged rapes that had specific biographical details attached to it, the family of this woman who was horrifically murdered on October 7th immediately came out and rebutted the claims and said, number one, you didn't tell us that this story was about sexual violence. You interviewed us under false pretenses. Number two, not only do we not believe that our loved one, her name is Gal Abdush, that she was raped, we see no evidence of that. And we also have evidence that points in the other direction. So immediately the family members of the most central figure in the piece say, this is not accurate. In addition, one of the eyewitness that they cite, it comes out that he has changed his stories multiple times. Some of the other individuals who they really rely on as being credible in this area, they're exposed to have been part of inventing some of these other inaccurate stories about beheaded babies, etc. So piece by piece, a lot of the key evidence falls apart. The most recent revelation with regard to the evidence is that the other two, so remember there were three specific rape allegations with biographical details in this piece. Well, Ryan Grimm and Jeremy Scahill went back to the kibbutz where the supposed other two rapes occurred of these two teenage girls who were, again, horrifically murdered on October 7th, and asked them what, you know, was this true, what the New York Times was reporting? And the spokesperson for Kibbutz Be'eri said, no, this is not true. They were, quote unquote, just murdered. And she even said, you know, I used the word just, but what happened here was not sexual assault. And so all three of the alleged rapes that they pointed to turned out to be inaccurate. In addition, the UN report that just came out, which I know we're going to talk more about, Rania, but also said that the rapes that were widespread in the media with regards to that same kibbutz were, quote unquote, unfounded. So you have effectively all of the evidence in this piece falling apart. The New York Times is refusing to do a retraction. They had originally planned an episode of their podcast, The Daily, around this piece. The piece had fallen apart so much that they, and this was also reporting from The Intercept, they were unable to go forward with that episode of The Daily, but they're not issuing a retraction. They're not going mm-hmm. back on any of this, even though these pieces have all been debunked. The other part that became incredibly important, because you ask yourself, well, how did this happen? Well, it turns mm-hmm. out that the two reporters who did the most extensive investigation on the ground, Anat Schwartz and Adam Sella, had almost no experience. Anat literally had no journalistic experience prior to, you know, getting scooped up somehow by the premier elite media outlet on the planet. And not only that, but she had a background in an IDF intelligence unit. So huge questions about how she and Adam Sella, who'd written a few pieces on food and cooking, how they're in charge of this investigation, why they got put on this piece, how this all passed muster, you know, what editors were involved. And instead of looking into any of that, the New York Times has instead gone after the people who have leaked this information that has, you know, that has come out and leaked to The Intercept and other publications. So it truly is developing into a scandal of Judith Miller, WMD, or caliphate level situation. And the bottom line is very similar, that they wanted to come to this conclusion, and thus they filled in the details. They ignored their own editorial standards in order to get there.
And yet we're going to jump into everything that you just mentioned a little bit deeper, but it is mind blowing, and the dangers of it too. We're living in this time where we can't trust the New York Times. So the implications of that, and how damning and damaging that is. And I do just have to name, from a very human perspective, the disgusting re-traumatization that happens for these families that have already suffered so much loss and now are having to come out and debunk and fight back against these allegations as well. So there, it just, the damage is so multi-pronged, and I just wanted to name that. But let's dive a little bit deeper into some of those dangers. You referenced the reporting from The Intercept, which again, yes, all the flowers go to Jeremy and Ryan and so many others. And they unearth these important facts. And I'm quoting, in the podcast interview, Schwartz details her extensive efforts to get confirmation from Israeli hospitals, rape crisis centers, trauma recovery facilities, and sex assault hotlines in Israel, as well as her inability to get a single confirmation from any of them. Excuse me. And you mentioned, like, they ignored their own journalistic standards. And then another article by Jeremy Scahill and again Ryan Grimm from Monday that quotes the kibbutz spokesperson as saying, and this is the spokesperson you were discussing and the kibbutz you were talking about earlier, Kibbutz Be'eri, that they quote the spokesperson as saying, it's not true. They were not sexually abused. So it's very clear. She does not mince words, the spokesperson. One thing that stands out from the story of the sexual assault in the kibbutz is a story told by the paramedic and denied again, just like you said, by the family, by contradictory physical evidence, is that Anat Schwartz cites this exact story, and she cites it as what convinced her. This is what's so mind-blowing. So she cites that story as what convinced her that Hamas had committed systematic sexual assault. And the Intercept reports a podcast interview that she gave in Hebrew in January, in which she says, quote, I say, okay, so what happened? One person saw it happened in Be'eri. So it can't just be one person because it's two girls, it's sisters, it's in the room. Something about it is systematic. Something about it feels to me that it's not random. And we'll include links to all of this in our show notes, but I obviously have lots and lots of thoughts here, but I want to hear from you about what else was false, what else was problematic? And I'm just, you know, we're naming things here. It just to flat out lie.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that podcast interview that Anat gave in Hebrew that Ryan and Jeremy and Daniel at The Intercept were able to get their hands on was so incredibly revealing. Because as you just described, she, first of all, was like, why do you want me to do this? I mean, she had doubts about herself having the qualifications to be able to push forward. And they said, oh, so this came from the New York Times. And she said, yes, 200%, I believe is what she said. Absolutely. They were the ones behind it. And then she goes to Jeffrey Gettleman, who's like the big dog on the piece, who by the way, side note, after this came out and after some of the things, you know, the credibility was called into question, he went out to the Hillary Clinton panel at Columbia University and said, what I see as a journalist, I'm not really looking for evidence. Like,
okay, I saw that. I saw that and I don't even know what to say. There are no words. Yeah.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Okay. So let's put him aside. So he tells Anant, don't worry about it. You got this. Just make sure you have two sources on everything. She's like, okay. Two sources. All right. Let me do this. So she goes out and starts scouring the country. As you described, she's talking to every hospital. She's talking to rape crisis centers and she can't find a single direct confirmation. And at every turn, she kind of justifies it, you know, well, and some of these things are true. Well, many of the women who may have been raped were killed. You know, there's no forensic evidence. Well, maybe that's because of Jewish burial rituals. You know, these rape crisis centers won't talk to me. Maybe they were just protecting their patient confidentiality. And so she even starts to question herself, like, am I just trying to manufacture something? Those weren't her words, but effectively she's saying, am I just trying to manufacture something that didn't really happen? And then that aha moment where she goes, no, I was right in my gut instinct and in my impression and my expectation of what I was going to find, was when she stumbles upon this story told by a single paramedic. Again, remember, she was told you must get two sources, but this was told by a single paramedic about two young girls, teenage girls, raped at Kibbutz Be'eri, which we now have just learned was completely fabricated by this paramedic. Even some of the details as to where they were and the position of their bodies. So this paramedic had said that they and another neighbor had reportedly said that the girls were found alone. Well, the family and the kibbutz say even that part's not true. They were with their mother. The mother also was murdered. They were all together. So even some of those basic details were inaccurate. Another instance that is cited in this report, again, with her supposed mandate to get two sources, that one came down to a single source at the Nova Music Festival. That source went on to tell different versions of that story. And so at bottom, you know, the quote unquote evidence, which I guess Jeffrey Gettleman says it's not really evidence anyway, but what came out in the report was all sourced to official Israeli government bodies. So,
which again, I have similar. To say, yeah, don't trust. I'm just going to say it out loud again. Yeah.
and they've given us no reason. And by the way, you shouldn't trust any government's word, sure. Right? You shouldn't trust Hamas's word. You shouldn't trust the U.S. Yeah. government's word, but the Israeli government has particularly given us a lot of reasons to very much doubt. And one thing that I thought was extraordinarily damning that the Intercept team uncovered as well is that when Anant and Adam Sella, the two other, you know, the two who were on the ground investigating this for the New York Times, they were trying to get use of this particular video of Gal Abdush. So you have the two teenage girls and you have the other woman, Gal Abdush, who was murdered, whose family also said, no, we don't think she was sexually assaulted. And they wanted access to this video, and the person who actually owned the video didn't really want to give it up. And the way they persuaded her was by saying, this is important for Israeli Hasbara, which of course is their word for propaganda. Think about that. Yeah. A journalist is out and out admitting, this isn't important for journalism. This isn't important to get to the truth. This is important so we can paint the picture that the Israeli government wants us to paint. And the last thing I'll say before I, go to the next question here is, I think in some ways it's easy to focus on Jeffrey Gettleman, Anant Schwartz, Adam Sella. They deserve a lot of scrutiny. Their names are on the byline, especially Gettleman, because he's the one with so much experience. But in a lot of ways, that lets the New York Times off the hook because they're the ones that put these people on this piece. They're the ones who pushed this piece forward, according to Anant Schwartz's own words. They're the ones who dropped all editorial standards to push it forward. They're the ones who continue to not correct the record, to not retract the piece, which is at this point what needs to happen. They ultimately bear all of the blame for what unfolded here. And it is at this point very clear, a tremendous scandal.
And that's incredible because, and you referenced this earlier, it's not just that they're not doing their own due diligence to ensure it never happens again. They're doubling and tripling down and saying we stand by it despite every hole that's been put into it. It's so It's so unbelievable. And I feel like if I was reading this in a script from a film and they were, and it was the New York Times, I'd be like, nope, nope, nope. Too outlandish, too much. Like it's so unreal that this is where we're at with not just any publication, but with the New York Times. It's really, right. It's so damning and damaging and unfortunate on so many levels, but moving Ryan, on because yeah.
Well, if I can just underscore one thing there, which is that again, journalists spend their entire careers trying to get a New York Times byline. This is yes. the Holy Grail, right? This is yes. the probably premier elite media institution in the world. Yes. And Anat Schwartz had never published a single piece prior to November of last year when she gets picked up as a contractor for the New York Times. Adam Sella, who one other piece is their relatives, which is apparently part of how the duo got brought onto this piece. He had published a few cooking and food pieces.
Yeah, food things. Right, exactly.
Aziz Squirrel was the one who dug into these backgrounds. How does that happen? She had been a small-time filmmaker and part of the IDF. How yeah. does that person get put on that piece? That to exactly. me is in some ways the biggest question that needs answering.
Which of course they're going out of their way not to answer, it seems. But whew, okay, deep breaths. So you mentioned this in your first answer, actually, some of the other lies and misinformation and propaganda that's been spread by the Israeli government, which is bad enough. We've all seen the parroting of that, but then perpetuated by our very own government, including President Biden, at some points from behind the seal of the president, which is staggering in and of itself. But I want you to talk about some of those things outside of this specific reporting. Let's talk a little bit about that. You've mentioned some of it already. Your thoughts on fabrication, exaggeration related to allegations of sexual violence again, and how has it impacted the excusing of mass murder, of genocide, of displacement, and of just completely decimating the livelihoods and the families and everything of the Palestinian people? And beyond that, how these kinds of situations can impact survivors and perpetuate just these harmful stereotypes that we've all heard. And then, sorry, this is like four questions in one. And then how would you have liked to have seen media responsibly cover these allegations from the Israeli government? Because they were going to make these allegations. That was not, you know, the media wasn't going to stop it. But what was the responsible way of covering it?
I mean, the responsible way is just to have a commitment to the facts and the truth. It's not that complicated to be skeptical of the claims of any official government source, to demand confirmation, to demand evidence, and you know, to lead with skepticism and with, frankly, common sense. You know, I think the primary goal of the Israeli government Hasbara with regards to this moment and with regards, let's be honest, to the entire Zionist project has been to completely dehumanize Palestinians, to deny they even yeah. exist as a people. You know, I saw one government minister just say, we need to get rid of the month of Ramadan and not be afraid of it. I mean, that's just cultural annihilation on top of yeah. the complete annihilation we're seeing in Gaza, the genocide that we're seeing unfold in Gaza. And so all of these stories about 40 beheaded babies, a baby found in an oven. And you're right, if memory serves, Joe Biden not only reiterated the beheaded baby story, he claimed he saw photographs, which we know
yes.
is yes. a lie.
It's not true. Right.
So horrific incidents. Again, there was enough barbarism on that day. It didn't need to be exaggerated, but a woman who was pregnant or a belly cut open and the baby stabbed. Israeli media has now debunked all of these instances. But the point of those stories and the point also of pushing forward the thus far unproved claim of mass rape as a weapon of war on that day, the end point is to dehumanize Palestinians, to say these Arabs, they're barbaric. They're not like you and I. You know, we shouldn't care if their culture and their lives and they're starved to death. We, you know, it's fine for us to do this because ultimately, and some famous comments have now come out, they are human animals and we're going to treat them as such. That's the real goal.
Yeah.
And to bring Absolutely. It back to Anant and the New York Times, you know, that dehumanized view of the world, that racist view of the world, was evident in some of the social media posts that were uncovered. Also, she on, I believe, October 7th, liked a post on Twitter that was so genocidal, it actually ended up in the South African ICJ filing at The Hague, alleging that Israel is committing genocide, that called for Gaza to be turned into a slaughterhouse. No one who actually sees Palestinians as full-fledged human beings could possibly like such a sentiment and think that that was acceptable and okay. She also liked other posts that were, you know, equally dehumanizing and horrific, and also called for, you know, a successful propaganda effort to turn Hamas into ISIS and equate that in the public mind, which again reveals her quote unquote journalistic mindset, which is not to seek the truth, but to seek a narrative that is going to help the Israeli government. So, you know, that is the core of all of this. When you ask yourself, how has the world stood by as a genocide is occurring on social media? How can these people at the New York Times and CNN and other places, how can they continue to look the other way? How can they continue to justify this? How can Joe Biden and these other quote unquote supposed liberals who 5 seconds ago were talking about the international rules-based order, how can they continue to ship these bombs? And at bottom, it's because they don't really believe that Palestinians are full human beings deserving of basic rights, basic dignity, et cetera.
And that is, and I'll tell you, as a first generation Palestinian woman in this country, it has been, this is not new either. And I think that is sometimes what's, it's infuriating, doesn't even, that's not enough, right? That's not the right word. I don't know what the right word is, but they are finally actually saying the quiet parts out loud. And then our own president is jumping on board, you know, our own, it's so unbelievable to watch this play out. And obviously none of us, you and I, and so millions and millions of other people, it's not like we're watching from the sidelines, but you see it and you hear it and you just go, this is, it's not new. And oh my God, this is real life. You know, this is not some, you know, cast of characters. This is the president of the United States and others that are perpetuating these harms. And I want to read this quote that would actually be really funny if we weren't talking about genocide and incredibly harmful and irresponsible reporting from the New York Times. But this is a quote from the former Times public editor, Margaret Sullivan, where she quote tweets actually Ryan's post on cutting ties with Schwartz. And she says, in her quote tweet, I refuse to call it X. I apologize to no one for it. But she says, I sometimes joke, it's another good day not to be the New York Times public editor, but the organization could really use one right now to investigate on behalf of the readers. And I just wanted to name that because, yes, like there is a certain expectation of journalistic integrity, everything that you just mentioned and more. It's just, it's, there are these expectations that we have certain places we can go for honesty, integrity, and journalism, et cetera. And the New York Times is at the bottom of that list. Wow, who would have thought? And so I do want to jump in. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
Well, I was just going to jump into the next atrocious thing that recently happened, and you also covered, which is the UN Secretary General's Special Envoy on Sexual Violence and Conflict. Their report that they just released. And I know you and I were actually texting about it because it was just another situation where I'm like, what am I missing here? It's sort of like the gaslighting is so prevalent that you see things in front of your own eyes and you go, what am I missing? How is this possible? So they released this report on Monday in which they said, they have, quote, reasonable grounds to believe that sexual violence, including rape and gang rape, occurred during the Hamas-led attack on Israel on October 7th. The report goes into some details about finding credible accounts of rape and other sexual violence. They also say they found clear and convincing information that some hostages taken to Gaza have been subjected to various forms of conflict-related sexual violence. Your reporting, which we will include in the show notes from yesterday, is extensive, and you read so much of the report, which is massively important. I read every word of this report, and I know you did too, and I just am floored. It's absolutely wild what you're reading, what the UN's own headline of the report is, what their conclusion is, but what's in the body of that report. So can you just give us a little bit on that? And again, we're going to include your reporting. It's so good. It's so extensive in the show notes, but go ahead.
Yeah. So let me try to give a few of the top lines here. So there were some issues with the report itself, issues that, in fairness, the report flags. For example, they said at the end of the day, they were basically forced to rely, much like the New York Times, on official Israeli government sources. Now, I would say the fact that you just note that, but you still include that as your what they describe as circumstantial evidence of sexual violence, I think that's a problem, but it's at least it's noted, it's made clear. The report is filled with caveats about the limits, and they don't call it an investigation. You know, they actually call on Israel to allow a full independent investigation, not only the into the claims of sexual violence against Israelis, but also the evidence of sexual violence against Palestinians that, of course, Israel immediately rejected out of hand. And there was a portion of this report dedicated to those indications that sexual violence was committed against Palestinians. That didn't make it into any of the media headlines for some reason, Rania.
Percent. Shocking.
For some reason,
I can't
that
believe
didn't make it.
Yeah.
And so there were some issues with the report, but the report was, I thought, very, very carefully worded and included a lot of very important caveats. In addition to noting they found reasonable grounds based on that circumstantial evidence of sexual violence on October 7th, they also said they were unable to determine whether it was widespread. So the report did not actually back up the view that rape was used systematically as a weapon of war on October 7th, which is the assertion of the Israeli government, which was the assertion of the New York Times in that now debunked piece, Screams Without Words. So that's, you know, the report, some of the top lines there. The way the media reported this, though, was actually far more egregious, in my opinion, than the report itself, because they asserted a lot more conclusiveness to this report than was actually evident if you read through the body of what the report was able to establish, what it wasn't, all of the caveats, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, bottom line with this report, as with the New York Times, they still have not been able to speak to a single actual victim of sexual violence on October 7th. They still have not been able to obtain a single piece of forensic evidence with regards to sexual violence on October 7th. So if you're trying to make the case this was widespread, this was systematic, and you still don't have a single victim account, you still don't have a single piece of forensic evidence, that seems very difficult to sustain at this point. And yet again, the you know, the media headlines and the way that they wrote this up, I thought was incredibly misleading of the limits, and did not establish the very clear limits laid out by the report itself of what they were able to find and how much investigation they were actually able to do. Because again, she didn't even, the woman that conducted this for the UN, she didn't even describe it as an investigation. It was very clear to not label it as such because she wants a full independent investigation to occur into these allegations.
And I believe she even said that it wasn't an investigation because they couldn't even get access to everything they needed to get access to. And she, and exactly what you said from the beginning, I mean, even UN Women, I think when the allegations started, said they were calling for a full independent investigation. And per the usual, the Israeli government has said, no, they're not cooperating. And in fact, so many of their spokespeople have gone out in the mainstream media and said, we don't need help. We don't need outside help to conduct our own investigations. And of course, I mean, who with two brain cells to rub together is going to buy that is what I would like to know. You know what I mean? And so, So it's to your point, it was almost like so many in the mainstream media read the headline of the report and ran with that and didn't read a single word that that was included within the actual body of the report.
Well, because Rania, they had all asserted, right, you know, used the New York Times piece oftentimes or similar claims that had fallen apart under scrutiny to assert that there had been widespread systemic rape. So they wanted that conclusion to justify their own flawed, failed, discredited reporting. And, you know, just to go back to the New York Times, where I referenced this at the beginning, but I think it's worth underscoring. Specifically in this UN report, they say that widespread media accounts of rapes at Kibbutz Be'eri were unfounded. They looked into it and they said, this is not true. Now, the New York Times did mention this in their write-up of the UN report. And their cope was, oh, but it was, they looked into different rapes than the ones that we based our piece on. So that was their analysis. But then that very same day, or perhaps the next day, Ryan and Jeremy are able to speak to the spokesperson at Kibbutz Be'eri, who says, no, 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 this one in the New York Times is not correct. But
and
again,
names them,
standing
names
by their
the
piece.
Victims. That's exactly. Right. This is what's so incredible. And I hate to be so, I don't know, blunt about it, but the kibbutz spokeswoman, there's zero reason to be like playing ball on any of this. And so, and then this like, oh, like you said, oh, it was something different. This is not what you looked into. And she's like, you know, and then names them. She herself named them. That's so right. It's really, really wild. And honestly, I feel like par for the course for the Israeli government, but the fact that we being the proverbial we as a country are, you know, perpetuating it. And we see this honestly, even from the beginning with the lies being told right after October 7th, which, like you've said multiple times, was atrocious and horrible in and of itself. What we know factually to be true was enough and still never justifies genocide and mass starvation and the destruction that's being perpetuated now. Right. But we also know that happens so often when these kind, I mean, this is extreme on a different level, but you know, when something not factual is reported and even a retraction is printed, it's the harm is done in so many ways. And you know, I work with a lot of different groups, a lot of different people, and there are people who are still talking about beheaded babies and babies in ovens and all the things, despite the overwhelming agreement, even among some of these mainstream media outlets that have been problematic, that that didn't happen.
Right.
So the snowball effect that this has, I'm not saying the New York Times should not be retracting it. Of course they could in a very big, massive way, but the implications are really dangerous. And we have seen them. We have seen what's happened in our own country because of it. I mean, a 6-year-old That's little right. boy was stabbed to death. Three boys in Vermont, in Burlington, were shot. I mean, we're seeing the impacts that these kinds of things can have. Do I know for a fact that, like, you know, this through line is direct? I don't have that, but I think we can make some assumptions there that this kind of rhetoric is so dangerous, and there is a responsibility among media outlets. So sorry to wax poetic on that, but as I do want just one more little point of privilege here and kind of an extension of this conversation, just talk about one more thing. At the very top, I mentioned earlier how difficult it is to come forward as a victim in any situation. This obviously being layered upon layer with so many different things going on. But I would really appreciate if you would close us out with just a final thought about irresponsible reporting and journalism like this, like the Times has put out and others, quite frankly, and how it makes it harder or could make it harder for victims to come forward.
I want to speak to that. I do want to underscore what you just said there, though, about how it's not just the Times, because and it's not even just the direct lies like the beheaded babies and, you know, mass sexual assault on October 7th, which, again, has not been proven. It's also the language that's used to describe Israelis versus Palestinians. Israelis are granted, you know, when they're killed, they're murdered, they're slaughtered. There's a clear accountability. It was Hamas who did it. When it's Palestinians, we saw this with the flower massacre that just occurred. Yeah. They died mysteriously, who knows how, in food-related deaths in a chaotic incident, right? And these are not one-off cherry-picked examples. There have been analyses done, again, by The Intercept was one that published a piece of these that shows the language that's used with Palestinians, which is very sanitized, which is they're never children, they're never mothers, they're never fathers, they're never slaughtered, they're never murdered, they just mysteriously die. With regards to Israelis, it's appropriately humanized language. And I do want to say one thing, which is, I think, positive, which is that because of the rise of independent media, because of the rise of social media and TikTok, you know, the American people, there has been a sea change in the way that they are viewing this conflict. Not just with regard to October 7th, you now have, you know, majority of Democrats saying we must stop shipping military weapons to Israel. You have a majority of the country that has said this whole time, even when Joe Biden was saying it was abhorrent, that we need a ceasefire. Overwhelming majority of Democrats agree with that. It's some 70% that say we need an immediate ceasefire and not the temporary humanitarian pause bullshit one, but a permanent ceasefire. Yes. You see a majority of Joe Biden voters saying this is a genocide. So in spite of the propaganda efforts, in spite of the lies, there is some truth that is getting through, that is hitting people on a human, visceral level. And hopefully one day.
Yeah. Well, and you're a large part of that. So I have to say thank you. You, Ryan, Jeremy, like this, you know, you are a huge, huge part of that. And I do have to say thank you, because it's so imperative. We are up against so much. And it, again, up against so much to just center humanity. That's it.
I feel so impotent, I have to tell you, Rania, and so disgusted every day. And I don't know how these people sleep at night. I genuinely don't. But back to your question about what this does to, you know, survivors of sexual violence and their willingness to come forward. Who wants their story to be weaponized in some government propaganda campaign? Who wants to be lied about and manipulated and these horrific lies and details that weren't even accurate put out to the world? Who wants to be the family like Gal Abdush's family, whose loved one was horrifically murdered on that day? And then you have to go out and parse whether she was raped and have this video of her with her dress up, you know, spread around the world by the New York Times. I don't know if you remember at the beginning of the conflict, I can't remember if it was Matt Miller, John Kirby, one of these ghouls that are spokespeople for the U.S. government, sort of casually floated that, oh, maybe the hostages, including the some American citizen hostages who may be held, maybe they're getting raped. And they actually had to retract that because the families were like, wait, what? Do you know that? Like, what the hell is,
is that happening?
Families, and you're hearing this from official spokespeople who are just talking out of their butts, who have no evidence, but who want the visceral horror of it. So, you know, it does tremendous damage to real survivors of sexual violence and their ability to tell their truth and tell their story, not have it weaponized, not have it manipulated, not be lied about and used in this grotesque game of then trying to use it to dehumanize this entire group of people and then justify things like genocide that are never justifiable in absolutely any circumstances.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much. Everything you said, plus. And I just, as we wrap up our conversation, I want to reiterate the way that the story has been spun, just like you said, for political reasons, for a narrative, for a purpose of narrative and propaganda, and how it's harmed the cause of achieving justice for victims of rape and sexual assault. And on all sides, it's also provided some people the excuse, just like you said, this is what they point to as the excuse to commit genocide against an entire population, to starve children to death, literally starve children to death, to absolutely decimate the lives of millions of human beings. And just like we talked about at the top and over, true independent investigations must happen for all the victims on all sides of this, and to enable them to get the justice and the accountability that every victim deserves. And I don't have all the answers. Not one person does, obviously, but I certainly don't. But what I do know is that irresponsible reporting and these flat out lies only ensure that we're going to continue remaining further and further away from a just peace for everyone, which is ultimately my goal and millions of other people's goals. And Crystal, I just can't thank you enough for spending time with me today. Your commitment again to truth and integrity in journalism, but just in everything, is imperative always, but especially right this moment. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in to this episode of Occupied Thoughts. Please make sure to check out the FMEP website. That's www.fmep.org for resources related to this podcast and lots of other great content related to Palestine and Israel. And please make sure you are subscribed to the podcast to stay up to date. You can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Spotify. And you can also watch the video version of our podcast, including this one, on YouTube. And with that, I'm Rania Patrice, signing off until the next episode of FM.